mean field theory of the Isaac model last time. And so we've derived this equation for the magnetization as a function of temperature. And so we were able to show analytically that the critical temperature here is just equal to J, right? And so when T is greater than Tc, this equation has only one solution, which is m equals 0. And so this describes the paramagnetic phase. While when T less than Tc, there are two non-trivial solutions. So m equals plus minus m0. And so this describes the ferromagnetic phase. So in general, this equation can only be solved numerically. It's a nonlinear equation. And so if we did that, we would find that M has the following form, M of T. So it's maximal and equal to 1, or plus or minus 1, but let me pick one sign, when T is equal to 0. And then it vanishes continuously and goes to 0 at T equals Tc. Okay? And so the important thing here is that M magnetization vanishes continuously as a function of T. So such transitions are called continuous or second order. And so we'll pretty much be studying such transitions in this class. Okay? And you will understand why. Pretty soon, okay, so this is a continuous transition. So now, so let's do the following thing. So let me make the following important observation that, so since M vanishes continuously at Tc, right? If I restrict myself to temperatures which are close to Tc, I can assume always that m is small, right? So on this side of the transition, m is just exactly 0, while to the left of Tc, it's non-zero. But if I'm close enough to Tc, I can assume that m is small, okay? So since M vanishes at Tc continuously, we can assume that M is small when T is sufficiently close to Tc. Okay? So what this means in particular is that I can take this complicated expression that I have derived for the free energy as a function of magnetization and expand it in Taylor series with respect to M. Okay? So we can expand F, the free energy as a function of M, in Taylor series. Okay, so let's do this expansion. So let me define a free energy per site, just to get rid of this factor of M, the total number of sites in the lattice. So I'll just divide my total free energy by the number of sites, right? And so this is equal to, as we found last time, J m squared over 2 minus T log of twice hyperbolic cosine of J m divided by T, right? And so let's now expand this function, log of twice hyperbolic cosine, in Taylor series, okay? And as we'll see, all we will need is the first two terms in this expansion, okay? So let me just write down the expansion. You can check me if you like. So this Taylor expansion has the following form. F, so the first term just enters as it is, then the leading term is going to be quadratic minus 1/2. So the leading term, of course, is going to be, so if I set m equals 0 there, then the cosine is going to be equal to 1, right? So the leading term is just minus t minus t log of 2, okay? So this is not 0, but it does not depend on t, okay? So it's just add some additive constant to the free energy. I will just ignore this term, okay? Since it does not depend on the magnetization. So then the leading term that does depend on magnetization is quadratic. It's minus 1/2 T J M divided by T squared, okay? And then the next term, so the third order term is absent by symmetry, right? Because this function is an even function of m. Okay, and then so the next term is quartic, and I get 1/12 t j m divided by t to the fourth, and so on. Okay, so for our purposes, as you will see, it will be enough to stop this expansion at this particular order. Okay. Let me use the fact that Tc, as we found, is equal to J, right? And so rewrite this expansion in the following way. So this is equal to, so I will replace this J by Tc and group those two terms together. So I'll get Tc over 2 m squared, and then 1 minus Tc divided by T, right? So this is from the first term, and this is from the second term in this expansion. And then this one is plus, again, I replace J by Tc, Tc to the fourth divided by 12 T cubed, m to the fourth, okay? Okay, so let's now plot this function as a function of m for different t's, right? For t greater than tc in particular, and for t less than tc. So when t is greater than tc, right, then so this ratio is less than 1, and so the coefficient of the quadratic term here is positive. Right, this coefficient of the quartic term is always positive, independent of whether t is less than tc or t is greater than tc. So this is always greater than 0. Okay, so let's first look at the case. This is f m, And so this is going to be t greater than tc, okay? So, okay, so the coefficient of m squared is positive, right? So this function then is a parabola, right? With a minimum at m equals 0 with some quartic correction. But essentially, it's just a parabola. Okay, so the function looks like this. Okay, and so the important thing is that there is a single minimum of this function at m equals 0. Okay? And so this tells us that the free energy, so when t is greater than tc, the free energy is minimized when m is equal to 0, as it should be, right? When t is greater than tc, the equilibrium value of magnetization is 0. Okay, so this corresponds to m equals 0. So then what happens when t becomes less than tc? So what happens is that the coefficient of the quadratic term changes sign, okay? And so then if I plot this function for t less than tc, f as a function of m, initially as I deviate away from 0, right, the quadratic term dominates, and so therefore this function is actually decreasing function of m, right? And it only becomes increasing again at larger values of m. So therefore, the shape of this function looks like this. Okay, so now the minimum, what was a minimum at m equals 0, what was a minimum of the free energy, has become a maximum, okay? It's still a solution of that mean field equation, right? Because that was just a solution of df dm equals 0, right? But so the minima now correspond to some non-zero, non-trivial value of m equal to m0, right? And m0 is a solution, is a non-zero solution of that mean field equation, okay? Sorry? Well, so if you just look at this function, right? So when t is less than tc, right? The coefficient of m squared here is negative, right? So therefore, at small m, this function decreases. Both, if I deviate in the positive m direction and negative m direction, right? Because the m to the fourth term at small m can be ignored compared to m squared. So initially, the function decreases, but then, of course, as I get to larger values of m, it has to start increasing again. So that's why I get minima at non-zero values of m.
That's still smaller.
Yeah, it's still small. So what I'm assuming here is that t is close to tc. Okay.
The f is the smaller or the capital F?
It doesn't matter. I mean, the small f and capital F are related by multiplying or dividing by n. Yeah. The shape of the function is going to be the same. Okay, so this is t less than tc. Okay. Okay, so what we can do now is actually find then how m behaves as a function of t when t is less than tc but near tc, okay? Because this function is much, much simpler than what we want, than this log of hyperbolic cosine, so we can actually minimize this function analytically and find the solution, right? Okay, so let's do this. Actually, right here. Okay, so I want to take this function now and calculate again df dm and set it to 0, right? So I get, tc 1 minus tc divided by t times m, right? And then plus tc to the fourth divided by 3 t cubed m to the third. This is equal to 0. So there is always a solution with m equals 0, which we are not interested in, right? And then the non-zero solution, so I divide by m, I get m squared is equal to, so 3 t cubed divided by tc cubed, right? And then I get tc divided by t minus 1, right? Or 3 t cubed divided by tc cubed. So tc minus t divided by t, okay? Let me actually write this in a slightly different way. Let me multiply what I have in the brackets here by t divided by tc, okay? And leave only t divided by tc squared in front. So this is equal to 3 t squared divided by tc squared. And then I have, so actually 1 minus t divided by tc, which is 3 t squared divided by tc squared, tc minus t divided by tc, okay? Okay, or then m is equal to plus or minus, so these are the two signs, right, that are required by the symmetry. And then I have t divided by tc square root of 3 tc minus t divided by tc, okay? And in fact, you know, since t is assumed to be close to tc, this coefficient I can just take to be 1, okay? So this is just equal to plus minus square root of 3 tc minus t divided by tc, okay? So usually it's written in the following way. So I can define what's called the reduced temperature or dimensionless temperature, which just measures the distance of the temperature from the critical temperature in dimensionless units, right? So I define reduced temperature small t, which is going to be t minus tc divided by tc, okay? And so then m behaves near the transition point as minus t to the power beta, where beta in this case is equal to 1/2. Okay? So this beta is called a magnetization critical exponent. Okay, and so, you know, the significance of this result is that, so in fact, as we will see, all not just magnetization, but all thermodynamic properties of the system depend on the reduced temperature near the transition in this kind of universal power law fashion. Okay? So what does universal mean? Universal means that you know, this critical exponent beta is a simple number, right? It does not depend on details of the model, like, for example, J, right, which tells you about the strength of the interaction between the spins, okay? So this is a universal power law dependence, okay? And so this, you know, this universality turns out to be a common feature of continuous phase transitions, and we'll talk about why that happens. And so this is what makes them interesting, okay? We're usually interested in things which are universal, which do not depend on details, which allow us to unify kind of many different phenomena under a single law, okay? And so continuous phase transitions exhibit that universality. So, well, we will talk about this a lot more in the future, okay? Okay, so now let me calculate a few more critical exponents just to illustrate this idea that not just magnetization but other thermodynamic properties behave near transition in this way. Okay, so let's let me do the following thing. Let me go back to my Ising model and let me add a uniform magnetic field. I will put this in quotation marks. A uniform magnetic field which couples linearly to the spins, right, and prefers a particular sign for them. Half h equals minus 1/2 sum over I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, and then minus b, sum over I, sigma I. So what I want to do, I want to calculate how magnetization responds to an applied external field. Okay? Okay, so I can still do the same, go through the same steps of derivation of the mean field theory. So let me just write down the result, the intermediate result for the mean field Hamiltonian, right? So I have minus mj sum over I sigma I minus b sum over I sigma I, and then plus this constant term, m squared. And so this, so you see that I can group this term and this term. So I get minus m times j plus b sum over I sigma I plus 1/2 n j m squared, okay? And so sometimes we will talk about this combination, J times the magnetization, as what's called a molecular field. So let me define B sub M as M times J, okay? So you see that this mean field Hamiltonian looks like Hamiltonian of spins, right? Non-interacting spins that exists in a field, in a magnetic field, which is a sum of the external field, B, right? And then this molecular field, B sub M, And so the physical meaning of this field is that, you know, this is an effective field that describes interaction of the spins with other spins in the lattice. Okay? So we have replaced interaction of a given spin with other spins in the lattice by this molecular field. Okay? And so we can also use, you know, so here I've used M as my order parameter. So order parameter is, I forget if I gave a formal definition of an order parameter. Order parameter is something that's not zero below TC and zero above TC. Okay, something that describes the transition. I can just as well use molecular field as an order parameter, right? Because it will have exactly the same property, that it's not zero below TC, but zero above TC. Okay. Okay, so then let's write down the free energy in this situation. So I have F, the total free energy, equals N J M squared over 2 minus NT log of twice hyperbolic cosine. And so here I just have to replace my JM by the total field, so molecular field plus the external field divided by T. Okay. Now, so if I minimize this free energy again, right, I will get pretty much exactly the same equation for M, except again the molecular field is going to be replaced by the total field, right? So is equal to zero. This gives me the following equation: M is equal to hyperbolic tangent of JM plus B divided by T. Okay. Okay. So now I am ready to calculate the response to the field. So what I want to calculate is magnetic susceptibility which is defined, so I'll call it chi, and so it's defined in the following way. It's a change of the magnetization in response to an applied field, right? So it's dm dB. Okay? So let's do the simpler case. Let's find this susceptibility for T greater than TC, okay? So the behavior for T less than TC is actually the same, okay? So if T is greater than TC, then in the absence of the field, right, the solution of this, the only solution of this equation is M equals zero, right? So therefore, what I can expect is that if the field is small, right, then the corresponding solution for M will also be small and proportional to B, to the external field. Okay. So for T greater than TC, we expect.
Sorry. Uh-huh. When you define susceptibility, is that a
you can define susceptibility at the finite field, and definition would be the same. But yeah, so I will be interested, of course, in the B equals zero case. Yeah. So when T is greater than TC, we expect M proportional to B when B is small. Right, and so since we expect both M and B to be small, or so I take B to be small, and then I expect M to be small, so then I can expand, again, this hyperbolic tangent in Taylor series to leading order. Okay. And so the leading order expansion of hyperbolic tangent is just the argument. So tangent of x is approximately x for small x. So then I get the following equation that m is equal to mj plus b divided by t. Okay. And I will again replace j by tc here. So then what I get is m. 1 minus tc divided by t, right, is equal to b divided by t. And so then I can just read off basically the expression for chi from this equation, right? So chi dm dB, but in this case it's simply m divided by b, right? And so this is equal to so this is equal to 1 over t, 1 divided by 1 minus tc divided by t, right? Or this is equal to 1 over t minus tc, okay? Which I can write in the same way as I did this expression for magnetization in terms of the reduced temperature. So this goes as 1, or this goes as t. Okay, let me. This goes as t to the power minus gamma, okay, where in this case gamma is equal to 1, okay? So this is called susceptibility. Critical exponent. Okay, and so you see that it has a similar form to the dependence of m on t, right? It's also a universal power law. The value of the critical exponent is different, of course, because this is a different quantity, but it's still power law and it's still universal. It's still the exponent is still a simple number. Okay, so if we did the same calculation below tc, we would find almost exactly the same dependence, except for a factor of 1/2 in front. So just trust me that for t less than tc, you would just get chi going as 1/2, 1 over tc minus t. Okay, and so then I can summarize both results in the following way. Chi near tc depends on the reduced temperature, or proportional to, depends on the reduced temperature as absolute value of the reduced temperature to the power minus gamma. Okay, and gamma is the same on both sides of the transition. Okay, so the important thing here is that you can see that susceptibility actually diverges on both sides of the transition as we approach the critical temperature. So what is the reason for that? So let's see. Let me draw this. So I have chi t tc. Okay, so susceptibility diverges with the same power law on both sides of the transition. So this is Well, it's easiest to understand if we are above TC, right? And reduce the temperature towards TC. So why does susceptibility diverge? It diverges because, so susceptibility measures response. Susceptibility measures magnetization that arises in response to the field, right? But so when I approach TC, the system, so what happens below TC is that the system develops spontaneous magnetization, even in the absence of the field. So therefore, as I approach TC, it becomes easier and easier for the system to magnetize in response to the field. And eventually at TC, that ability basically is infinite, okay? Because the system just magnetizes by itself, even without the field, okay? So to understand this below TC, you have to think about fluctuations, right? So if I, let's say, magnetize my system in a particular direction, let's say this M positive, right? And then I apply field in the opposite direction. And I want to see how easy it is to reduce magnetization by the field, okay? And again, that ability diverges at TC because at TC, in this case, magnetization just vanishes, okay? Yeah.
Now you got the magnetization doesn't, sorry, the susceptibility doesn't go to zero as T goes to zero. Nor is LV2 far away.
Well, so susceptibility, in fact, does go to zero as T goes to zero. Yeah, but what I've, you know, this is not necessarily zero. So what I've plotted here is just what happens near TC. Yeah. I mean, the reason it goes to zero at t equals zero is because, you know, m just becomes maximal possible, reaches maximal possible value at t equals zero, which you cannot change. Yeah.
So the fact that minimizing free energy gives me the expectation value of magnetization, is it a model dependent statement?
No, it's not. So, you know, so in this theory, we treat m as a parameter, right? So I have free energy that depends on this parameter, and to find the equilibrium state, I have to minimize the free energy as a function of this parameter.
So can you remind me why minimizing it gives me the expectation value?
Well, no. So minimizing the free energy gives you the expectation value that corresponds to the equilibrium state. Okay. I mean, it's like, you know, let's say if you take ordinary statistical mechanics, right? So there are different thermodynamic potentials you can define, like the Helmholtz free energy, Gibbs free energy, and so on. And so they are their significance is that they are minimized in equilibrium under certain conditions. Let's say if I take Helmholtz free energy, this is minimized in equilibrium when, I don't know, T and V are constant. Right? Mm-hmm. But then the other parameters, so I have to minimize the free energy with respect to other parameters, like, I don't know, like entropy, let's say, to find the equilibrium state. So it's the same idea here. Okay. M is just such a thermodynamic parameter, right?
Like, so here we are using some input from thermodynamics to make this
clear. Well, the input from thermodynamics is just that I'm treating M here as a thermodynamic macroscopic parameter that describes the equilibrium state of the system. So it's like, you know, similar to pressure, I don't know, volume, temperature in ordinary thermodynamics. It's just an additional parameter here. Okay? So, you know, in principle, as we will see, this is not, this is one of the reasons that, again, that probably the main reason, in fact, that the mean field theory fails, okay? So one, in fact, cannot treat M as just a parameter, okay? M, in fact, can fluctuate spatially, and that's the reason that and mean field theory does not take that into account. And that's why mean field theory fails. But that's coming later. Okay? Okay, now let's calculate just one other critical exponent. Let's see how the specific heat depends on T near TC. So let me erase this thing here. So let's look at the behavior of the specific heat. Okay, so specific heat, let me just remind you what that is. Okay, so specific heat, and I will calculate a particular specific heat at constant volume. Okay, so that measures basically how, let me write it like this, dQ dT at constant volume, where dQ is equal to TdS. So this is a heat transfer to the system, right? So specific heat measures so the amount of heat you have to transfer to the system to raise its temperature by 1 unit, right? So it's an example, you know. So this is a, and this is an example of a response function, right? Magnetic susceptibility. It measures response of the system to applied external field. This is also an example of response function. So it measures response of the system to external heat flow. Okay. So this is an example of a thermodynamic response function. So this can be measured, and you know, measurement of the specific heat is in fact one of the very important characteristics, experimental characteristics of all you know, solid state systems. Okay, this tells you a lot about the state of the system. Okay, so let's calculate how the specific heat behaves here. Okay, so. So I can write CV in the following way from here as just T dS dT at constant volume, right? And as you know, S, the entropy, can be calculated as minus derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature at constant volume. Right, so therefore CV is related to the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature at constant volume. Okay. And let me actually calculate the specific heat per lattice site, just to again eliminate this dependence on the size of the system. Okay. Okay, so let's use this expression for F that we found, which is I guess on this middle board, that we found by expanding it in Taylor series, right? So we are interested in this dependence near TC. So I have F equals TC over 2, 1 minus TC over T, M squared, and then plus TC to the fourth, 12 T cubed, M to the fourth, okay? Now, what I want here, right, is actually F as a function of T explicitly, right? And F corresponding to equilibrium. So what I want is now to take this dependence of M on T that we found by minimizing this with respect to M and plug this in here, okay? Then I will actually get the dependence of the equilibrium free energy on T, Okay, so I want to take M of t equals plus minus square root of 3, so tc minus t divided by tc, right? And plug this in this expression for f, right? Okay, so if I do it, I get f equals tc over 2, 1 minus tc over t. So m squared gives me 3 tc minus t divided by tc, right? And then here I get plus tc to the fourth, 12 t cubed, and then m to the fourth, so this is going to be 9 tc minus t divided by tc squared, okay? So then this is equal to, so this is going to give me minus 3/2 1 over tc, and then tc minus t divided by tc squared, right? Made a mistake. So just t minus tc squared, okay? Right? So what I've done here, I've written this as t minus tc divided by t, right? And then replace this t in the denominator by tc, because t is close to tc, okay? And then this thing, so it's plus, again, let me replace this t cubed here by tc cubed, and then I will get plus 3/4 of the same thing, right? Tc times t minus tc squared. So the whole thing is equal to, so minus 3 over 4 tc, t minus tc squared, right? So that's how the free energy depends on temperature near tc. Okay, so now we can calculate the second derivative easily. Well, so what I'm interested in is kind of leading order terms with respect to deviation of t from tc, right? There will be, I can write this t as, you know, tc minus t plus, t minus tc plus tc, right? And then expanding t minus tc, and this is the leading order term, right? That is proportional to t minus tc, right? Okay, so let me erase this. So if I calculate my CV now per site, minus t d2 small f dt squared, right? So this is just equal to 3 halves of t divided by tc, right? And so this would be true for t less than tc, because to obtain this expression, right, what I've done, if I've substituted the equilibrium dependence of m on t, right, which is only valid when t is less than tc, above tc m is just 0. So then I obtain the following dependence of this specific heat on temperature, so Cv and then T. So specific heat is linear in T for T less than Tc, and then at Tc it jumps to 0, right? And the magnitude of this jump is just 3 halves. Okay. So that 0, of course, is not, this is not, should not be taken literally, right? This is only the part of the free energy that depends on the magnetization, and that has this singularity at Tc. I have neglected other contributions to the free energy which are not singular at Tc, okay? So they will give some smooth function of T, some smooth contribution to the specific heat, which does not have any singularity at Tc. So the important thing is this jump. The jump will still be there, okay? Okay, so it turns out that, like all the mean field theory results, this really is almost never observed. Okay, so in reality, what happens to the specific heat, at most second order transitions, is that specific heat actually diverges at Tc. Okay, so it may look like something like this jump if you are far enough away from Tc. But then actually, as you come close, what happens is a divergence, which may have this kind of shape, okay? So typically, we therefore write that Cv depends on the reduced temperature in the following way, as absolute value of T2 minus alpha, okay, where alpha is positive. And so this is called specific heat critical exponent. And we will obtain a non-zero result for alpha later. But so basically, what this tells us, so the fact that in mean field theory we do not get a divergence, but just get a finite jump equal to 3 halves. So this means that in mean field theory, alpha is equal to 0. Right? So the mean field theory result for alpha is alpha equals 0. Okay? So it still conforms to our idea that things have to behave as universal power laws. It's just that the exponent is 0 in this case. Okay, but in reality, it's not in most cases.
Where did you get alpha?
Well, I mean, if I write it like this, right? If alpha is not zero, then it would diverge. So a constant is basically corresponds to a power law with zero exponent.
Negative.
So it could be, but it never is.
How do I see that it will be 0?
Sorry?
How do I see that alpha
Well, it's just, you know, so if alpha is, so, okay, so if alpha is positive, right, then this would say that specific heat diverges at TC. So it does not, right? If alpha, if I chose alpha to be negative, that would mean that specific heat vanishes at TC on both sides. It does not, right? It's a constant on this side. Well, it's zero on this side, but it's a constant on this side.
It's not constant, it's linear.
No, it's constant at TC. So if I take the limit of T going to TC, right, it's going to be a constant. It does not vanish. Well, so then the only thing that's consistent with that is alpha equals zero, right?
But then if alpha is zero, then it looks like it's continuous.
So, you know, well, so the way to look at that is the following. So if I start, let me take alpha to be positive, right, but small, and plot CV as a function of T. So what I will see is that, you know, it looks like pretty much, you know, something like this jump everywhere, except when I get very, very close to TC. That's when I start seeing the divergence. And as I take alpha to zero, right, that divergence becomes narrower and narrower, and eventually disappears as alpha is going to zero. Probably that's the way to think about that. It's a limiting case of this jump is kind of a limiting case of alpha becoming very small and going to zero from above.
What's alpha in the real case?
Sorry?
What's alpha not of the exact situation?
Well, alpha is positive always, basically. You know, so the only real observed, experimentally observed phase transition for which alpha is pretty much zero to experimental precision is the superconductor to normal metal transition in non-high TC, you know, ordinary metallic superconductor. So there, it turns out, for, you know, for reasons that I won't talk about, mean field theory is extremely precise for such superconductors. Basically, you know, well, the reason is that the superconductivity arises from pairing of electrons, okay? And so in ordinary metallic superconductors, those pairs are very large in size, okay? So that makes, turns out that it makes mean field theory work very well, okay? And so even though, again, in reality, if you could measure the specific heat with extremely high precision in a superconductor, you would see that it eventually starts diverging, but it's just well beyond experimental precision. And what you see in experiment is, in fact, something that looks like this jump.
Yeah, but in general, the superconductor, the phase transition, It's not in the same universality class as icing, right?
No, it's not. But, you know, so mean field theory doesn't, it's just one universality class for everything. I'll talk about this later. Okay, now, so, we see that we can, in general, at least describe a continuous phase transition using mean field theory. So Landau realized that we could actually obtain all of those results in a much simpler and a more straightforward way without actually doing any calculations and without even referring to a specific starting model. Okay. So Landau realized that mean field theory results follow from very general symmetry considerations. So basically, so we've obtained all of those results basically from this expansion of the free energy, right, in Taylor series with respect to the order parameter or magnetization M, right? But the point is that I could have written down this expansion without doing any calculations, just based on symmetry considerations. So why is that? Well, so what is the important symmetry consideration for this for the Ising model, right? So the point is that the Ising model Hamiltonian is invariant under changing sign of all the spins, right, as we discussed last time. Under sigma I going to minus sigma I for all sides. So a consequence of that is that the free energy as a function of the magnetization, as a function of the order parameter, has to be an even function of M, right? It cannot depend on the sign of M. So F as a function of M has to be an even function of M, right? So therefore, its Taylor expansion near TC has to contain only even powers of M, right? So then, ignoring a constant term, which doesn't matter, I can always write, so just based on the symmetry consideration, I can write my Taylor expansion as some coefficient R M squared plus U M to the fourth, right? And then, so the only thing I need to require now is that the coefficient of the M squared term depends linearly on T minus TC, okay, and changes sign at TC. So if I require that R is proportional to T minus TC, so it's positive above TC and negative below TC, and U is just a positive constant, right? And U has to be a positive constant just from the, you know, so if I take M to infinity, right, just on physical grounds, the free energy has to become infinitely large, because otherwise I would get nonsense results, right? I would get an infinite magnetization and equilibrium. So U has to be positive, okay? So just those two requirements and this form for F of M is enough to derive all of the results I have derived. Yeah? So it could. But so the idea is that I want to write R as a function of, let's say, this reduced temperature, right? So reduced temperature goes to zero at TC. So therefore, I can write R in Taylor as a Taylor expansion, right? So I get some coefficient A T plus B T cubed and so on. But OK, so there is no reason that this linear term has to vanish, right? It might vanish, but in general, it should not, right?
Is there any, like, you get any interest in physics with
I'm not aware of that, no. So in most cases, I guess, or always, even this linear term is just not zero. Yeah.
What was the question so that I don't ask the same question over again?
Well, the question was, you know, so I said that I take R to be proportional to T minus TC. I mean, what I really must have is that R vanishes at TC, right, and changes sign.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, I could have said that, let's say, R is proportional to T minus TC cubed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, that could happen, but that would require some very special circumstances, which would make the coefficient of the linear term go to zero.
And those considerations.
So genetically, this just doesn't happen.
Those considerations go from our knowledge of the behavior.
Well, so of course, you know, the Landau got this idea from looking at this microscopic mean field theory that we have done.
Okay.
But the point is that you can then generalize these ideas. And so, the power of this is that you don't even have to know the specific details of the microscopic Hamiltonian. All you have to know is what is the order parameter and what are the symmetries of the Hamiltonian with respect to this order parameter. And that's enough to write down this theory. Okay? Yeah?
We wrote down the form of R because you can minimize F with respect to M, then the form for M that we get, M should go to 0 at t equals to 0.
Right.
So the coefficient before M to the power 4 should also behave the same?
No, so this coefficient is positive, right? So this coefficient is always positive, but, so if R is also positive, then this function only has one minimum at M equals 0. While if R is negative, the minimum at M equals 0 turns into a maximum, and you get two additional minima at non-zero M. Okay? So the only thing you have to reproduce is basically this behavior of this function f of m, right? It has to be simple parabola for t greater than tc, and it has to have two minima at non-zero m at t less than tc. Okay? That's the only thing that's important. Okay, so then, this idea suggests then that all continuous phase transitions should be described by this theory, right? And then for all continuous phase transitions, we would get the same values for the critical exponents, okay? So, over this thing. So this suggests that all continuous phase transitions have exactly the same critical exponents.
Okay?
So it actually does not depend on the symmetry, right? Whatever the symmetry, you will always get basically this kind of form. And you will always get same critical exponents.
You get the same critical exponents in this
paper? Sorry?
You get the same critical exponents in this paper?
Yeah. It's also mean field critical exponents. So this suggests that all continuous transitions have the same critical exponents, meaning that the critical exponent describing how order parameter vanishes at tc, so beta is always 1/2. The critical exponent that describes the response of the order parameter to whatever the field, whatever is the field that couples to the order parameter, is going to be -1. The specific heat critical exponents is going to be 0. And so on. So there are a few other critical exponents, but that's not important. But so this is just not true. Okay. So what's observed experimentally is that critical exponents are different in general for different phase transitions. Okay. So this is too good to be true. Okay, so in reality, what's observed is that all the continuous phase transitions can be classified into a finite number of what's called universality classes. Continuous transitions may be classified into distinct universality classes. So two transitions are said to belong to the same universality class if they are characterized by the same set of critical exponents. Okay? Yeah.
I still don't understand why this would suggest that all continuous.
Well, you can just check, you know. So you can try to write down a mean field theory for any possible situation, and you will see that you will always get the same critical exponents.
Even though
it's just
form depends on the fact that it's invariant under, or that it's an even.
Well, so yeah, so it's okay. So it's a particular type of symmetry here, right? So here we have an order parameter that's just a scalar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a magnetization that can only point in a particular direction, right? So, I mean, we could generalize it to a multi-component order parameter. I can have magnetization that points in all three directions, let's say in three-dimensional space. So all that would change is that this M would become a vector now. So I would get R M dot M here, right, again by symmetry, plus U M dot M squared, right? And you can easily convince yourself that you will get exactly the same dependence. All right, so when you minimize the free energy with respect to M, right, M has to choose a particular, still has to choose a particular direction in which to point, right, and then it immediately just transforms back into this form, right? You pick a particular component for M, and that's it, and you minimize with respect to that. You can take more complicated cases like the theory of BCS theory of superconductivity, right, or Ginzburg-Landau theory of superconductivity, which you can derive from BCS, or also write down based on the symmetry considerations, and you will also see that. So in that case, the order parameter is a complex number, right, which would be like a two-component real number, real order parameter here. You will see that, again, the critical exponents are the same. So this comes, this follows just from the fact that we treat the order, this order parameter as a parameter, as a single parameter that describes the whole system, just like, I don't know, pressure, let's say, right, in equilibrium. So just that assumption immediately leads to mean field critical exponents. So the only way to obtain something different is to allow, and so we will see how to do that later, is to allow M to actually fluctuate in space. Okay? Okay? Okay, so again, so in reality, so, you know, this in this language, this Landau theory would suggest that all continuous phase transitions belong to a single universality class. There is always, the critical exponents always have these values. Okay? So in reality, there are different universality classes. And so it's found that which universality class the transition belongs to depends on the following things, typically. So universality class is, let me actually write it there. Class of particular transition. So it depends on the nature of the order parameter. So for example, example that I gave, the number of components of the order parameter typically changes the universality class, okay? Even though it's not the case in mean field theory, in reality, the new universality class does depend on the number of components of the order parameter, okay? So number of components of the order parameter. So you know, if you take the example of a ferromagnet to paramagnet transition in reality, right? So the Ising model would describe ferromagnet to paramagnet transition in a magnet with uniaxial, what's called uniaxial anisotropy, right? Where the magnetization is forced, there is some preference for a particular axis that often happens in crystals, let's say, right, which are not rotationally symmetric. However, if there is rotational symmetry, if there is no preference for a specific axis, you can also have a ferromagnet to paramagnet transition, but it will always belong to a different universality class. The critical exponents will be different.
That's Heisenberg.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it depends. So if it's three components, it's Heisenberg. If it's easy plane anisotropy, it's XY model. So we will talk about all of those models later.
Is there a difference between having like just two vector components and being a complex
number? Not so well. So it does matter for the superconductor to normal transition. And the reason is that in this case, there is also coupling to, it's not just a complex number, it's a complex number that carries electric charge, and it's coupled to electromagnetic field. And the electromagnetic field plays a role in the transition. So you could say superfluid to normal transition, right? So in, let's say in helium, in this case, helium atoms are neutral, they don't couple to electromagnetic field. And so then there is no difference between just a complex number or a two-component real number, which is the same symmetry. Okay, so number of components, symmetry. And typically, the critical exponents also depend strongly on the dimensionality of space. Okay, so here in mean field theory, the dimensionality of my lattice, right, on which the Ising model is defined doesn't enter anywhere. So the results would be the same independent of dimensionality. In reality, critical exponents actually very strongly depend on dimensionality. So of space. So, you know, so continuous phase transitions are not as universal as suggested by mean field theory. The critical exponents do depend on certain things, but they are still universal in the sense that those things are very general, right? This has no dependence on microscopic details, right? So these are kind of macroscopic properties, number of components of the order parameter, symmetry, and dimensionality of space. Yeah.
Do we only have three critical exponents? Or are there
any? No, there are others, but you know, so others can be actually obtained from those using what's called scaling relations. So in principle, you know, for any thermodynamic quantity, there is a separate critical exponent. Okay, but they're not independent of each other.
So that's the only independent
one? Well, so in principle, yeah. So in principle, you can always obtain critical exponents from any two, actually. Okay. But so we will introduce more critical exponents later. Okay. Okay, so as I've already mentioned, the reason that that mean field theory fails, so you know, yeah. Well, so you know, so this M here is a scalar, right? Yes, and that comes from that follows from the fact that my microscopic Ising model, right, the spins can only point along one direction. This one component, sigma can be either plus one or minus one. So that can be described by a single component real number, right? So if my spins were actually vectors that can point in different directions, so then I would, my M would also have to be a vector. So we will talk about all those cases later. Okay? So you know, mean field theory is still valuable in the sense that it shows in a very simple way how it demonstrates in a very simple way this. Kind of very general property of second order phase transitions that thermodynamic quantities behave near this transition in the universal power law fashion. But the details, namely the actual values of the critical exponents and their dependence on those things, so they are not captured by mean field theory. Okay? So in this sense, mean field theory fails. And the reason for this, as I've already mentioned, is the fact that we treat this magnetization here, or the order parameter more generally, as just a single parameter that does not depend on the spatial coordinates. Okay? So to improve on mean field theory, we have to develop somehow a theory that treats this order parameter as a fluctuating field that can have different values in different points in space. So that's what I want to start now. So to improve, on mean field theory, we have to treat M as a fluctuating field and not as just a uniform parameter. And you know, this makes sense physically, right? So if you think about magnetization and the magnet, let's say, it does not have to be uniform and just uniformly go to zero as t goes to dc. What actually happens is that it fluctuates spatially, right? So the question is, how do we capture this theoretically, right? So let's again go to the Ising model. Minus 1/2 sum over I and j ij, sigma I, sigma j, right? And so what I'm going to do now is apply the following mathematical transformation, which is called Hubbard Stratonovich transformation. So this was invented basically by a Russian mathematical physicist, Stratonovich, and then kind of popularized and applied to condensed matter and statistical physics by Hubbard. Okay, so this transformation is based on the following very simple mathematical identity. So the identity is the following. So 1 over root 2 pi of an integral from minus infinity to infinity d phi, so phi is just a real integration variable, of e to minus 1/2 a phi squared plus b phi. So this is just a, you know, Gaussian integral, right? E to exponential of a quadratic function of the integration variable. So I'm assuming that this integral converges, which means that a has to be non-negative or positive, right? And b can be anything. So this, as you probably know, this is just equal to 1 over root a e to b squared divided by 2a, right? So it's an exponential of basically the square of the coefficient of the linear term here divided by the coefficient of the quadratic term. Now, so Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation is just a multidimensional generalization of this identity. So I want to now generalize this identity for an integral over many, many real variables. Okay? So let's generalize this. To multi-dimensional integrals. So suppose I have an integral over now n real variables. So I'll have a factor of 1 over 2 pi to the power n over 2 in front. And I have integral from minus infinity to infinity d phi 1 d phi n, right? And I will generalize this quadratic function to a general quadratic form, right? So I'm going to have e to minus 1/2 some matrix capital A I j phi I phi j, and I'm using here the Einstein summation convention, right, where repeated indices are assumed to be summed over. And then the linear term plus, so vector bi multiplied by vector phi I. Okay. So then I'm not going to prove this result, but you can easily show that you will probably do this in your tutorial, okay? That so a generalization of this result is the following. This is equal to, so instead of 1 over root A, what I will have is 1 over root of the determinant of the matrix A. Okay. And then, so instead of 1 over A here, I will have the inverse matrix. Okay, so this is equal to E to plus 1/2. So A inverse IJ BI BJ. Okay. And this is not, you know, inverse of the matrix element. This is the matrix element of the inverse matrix. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I'm assuming here that A is positive definite, meaning all eigenvalues of A are positive, so that this integral converges. You can easily show this just by diagonalizing the matrix A, right? And then this Hamiltonian simply breaks up into n independent Hamiltonians of this form, where individual A's will be just the individual eigenvalues of the matrix. Yeah.
Should power n's with 1 over determinant A?
Sorry?
Should should that be to the power
in the denominator?
So it's 1 over root a here, and it's 1 over root of the determinant of a, So that determinant of a is just a product of the eigenvalues.
And you're crediting this to these people, or to the guy on the right-hand side?
Well, no, so I'm not crediting the identity itself. This is just a Gaussian integral. I'm crediting the application of this to what I'm going to talk about. Okay? And in fact, you know, this identity is very extremely useful. It's not just useful for the description of the phase transitions. It's also a general method, basically, of converting kind of particle theories into field theories. So it's useful in quantum field theory. It's useful in condensed matter physics, and it's useful here. Okay. Okay. So let's continue.